Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, and welcome to the Just Interesting podcast, the show where everything's interesting, nothing is boring, and hopefully everything is exciting, maybe? I'm not entirely sure why I said that. I'm promising things
don't promise
that I can't deliver.
Things,
no! Well, joining me, Robin, are Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello.
How are you doing?
How am I doing? I'm doing well, thank you. Yeah, feeling better than last week. Good.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah, I don't know. What else is there to say? Not a whole load.
Well, this is going to be a fascinating podcast, isn't it? And Alex, how are you?
Do you feel bad now, Robin, for saying that this is going to be an exciting podcast?
You've already completely undercut me.
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Not too bad. Had an exciting day out yesterday. Went to the seaside.
Oh, you didn't mention that before the podcast.
I told Robin, actually. I didn't tell you. You were running late.
I was a bit late to the game.
So, late to the game. You weren't.
What did you do at the seaside?
We just had a walk around, got fish and chips.
Yeah.
Came back because everyone was on the beach being, you know, being mad and not even caring. So it was a bit scary, I guess. But other than that, it was lovely. Yeah. It was lovely, apart from all the people not socializing.
Yeah, everyone's spreading COVID. Other than that, it was lovely. Yeah.
So this episode, we'll be talking about our three favorite UFO sightings and why they're so compelling. Because we spent years looking into the strange and the weird and the supernatural, and UFOs are one of our favorite things. So we thought we'd each of us pick our favorite UFO story and talk about it and see. Actually, I'm looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say. I don't know how believable, how credible the ones that you've picked are, but I'm looking forward to what you've got, and hopefully we won't have picked the same ones. It would be a bit awkward.
Yeah,
we probably should have checked that, shouldn't we, before we before we started recording.
A bit more organized, shouldn't we? And of course, after that discussion, we'll have the weekly quiz, which I'm hosting. So luckily, that means I can't lose this week. It means one of you has to lose.
You were never going to lose, Robin, were you? This season's already a joke.
No, it's not. Martin's in the lead. Martin's got 100%.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, Martin, stop me. What am I on about? Sorry, Martin. I just assumed Robin won last week.
No. That's fair enough. Like, he's been winning for so long.
You were there.
I was there. I was the host, yeah.
But before we get into all that, we'll be looking at your comments on the YouTube channel, addressing your comments and your questions of the week. And before we get into that, we'll be discussing what we learned. But before we get into that, I just want to say a massive thank you to all of our Patreon supporters. All of you, old and new, thank you for keeping this channel going. And if you want to join us, you'll get exclusive access to our extra podcast, which is a little more interesting. Well, I want to sip on my lovely beer and hear what you guys learned this week. So, Alex, tell me.
Okay, well, as you guys know, one of the best films ever made is Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift. You know, obviously.
Panned
by critics, but everyone else pretty universally agrees it's one of the best films ever made. So I've got some trivia about Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift for you. And this was, I found this really interesting. Basically, Universal Studios, apparently, according to Justin Lin, the director of the film, paid for someone to be arrested by Japanese authorities during the filming.
What?
So basically, Justin Lin wanted to shoot in Tokyo, shoot this like car chase scene in Tokyo in one of the most busy districts in Tokyo. And Tokyo's, he said it's quite difficult for location shoots because Japanese authorities just refuse to give out permits.
Right.
Yeah. But he said that Japanese authorities are really lovely. They're really polite. So when people are filming, they'll wait for like 10 minutes and then come and chuck you out. So he basically, they didn't get permits to shoot in this central Tokyo area. So they just went and filmed it. And then after 10 minutes, they got all their shots and the Japanese police came over. And he, Justin Lin, thought they were going to get chucked out. But instead, they tried to arrest him. But then this person stepped up and said that he was the director, so they arrested him instead. And this person was paid by Universal Studios to go out there for this very reason, to be arrested by Japanese authorities in this instance. So that was his, that was their job. Well, that was paid for the film,
just to
be arrested. Yeah, they hired a full guy for when they inevitably got arrested. How weird is that?
That's not actually a bad idea, is it? I mean, you've got to choose the right person.
Yeah.
Someone who's okay with getting arrested and it won't ruin their their life.
I mean, if you put an ad saying person wanted to be paid to get arrested in Japan, then you're probably going to get the right kind of people applying.
I mean, this is the opposite from most job applications, which is must have a criminal record.
Yeah, that's true. But apparently Justin Lin didn't even know that this was what the guy's job was until he actually stepped up. Apparently he met him beforehand and the guy just said that he said, "I'm you," to Justin Lin. And Justin was like, "I didn't know what he meant by that." and then he got arrested and apparently that was his job.
Wow.
I'm Spartacus.
Oh, exactly. But yeah, exactly.
Wait a second. If he's pretending to be, I assume they didn't know the director of the movie was Justin Lin. Otherwise, the guy is pretending to be Justin Lin, in which case Justin Lin still has the criminal record in Japan, doesn't he?
I mean, it must be under a different working title, right, of the movie.
Yeah.
This person was attributed to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought that was an interesting glimpse into the how these amazing, incredible films get made. But that's what I learned this week. Always up for a bit of Fast and Furious trivia. So, yeah.
It is non-ironically, it's your favourite film franchise of all time, isn't it?
Oh, I probably know more about it than most people. And I'm pretty humble, so, you know.
But I will beat you.
I will beat you.
Fast and Furious quiz.
Well, luckily, the theme of today's quiz is not Fast and Furious.
Phew, I've only seen the second one. So this week, I learnt about elephants, a fact about elephants. And that fact is that they rarely get cancer.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's pretty mad. So most big creatures and creatures that last a long time, including humans, you know, one in two of us get cancer within our lifetimes. That's the stat, isn't it?
Is it that many? Gosh.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the one that's pulled out at the fundraisers, you know, the television fundraisers. Yeah. I think it's one in two now, which is mad. That's... people are living longer, people are generally getting more cancer.
Wow.
So elephants should really get cancer because they live quite a long time and they're big old creatures, but they don't. And the reason for this, something that puzzled scientists for years and years, was that they have extra copies of two cancer-fighting genes.
Oh,
so these are very trendily named P53, which is a particular gene which apparently hunts for cells with miscopied DNA, which can cause cancer, and LIF6, which apparently obliterates the mutated cells before they can form tumours.
Whoa. Wow.
So these two genes have basically meant that there are really, really low rates of cancer with elephants. So the researchers looked at the evolution of elephants and found that this second gene, LIF6, actually became inactive in elephants' DNA millions of years ago and then mysteriously came back to life. So they lost this ability to fight off and get rid of these mutated cells. But for some reason, this came back to life. And researchers don't know why this is the case yet, but they're finding ways in which they can use this knowledge to hopefully help treat cancer in human beings going forward. Yeah, so
I mean, that's what I was going to ask. Yeah. I didn't want to be selfish about it, but I was like, is there any way that we can profit from this?
Yeah, yeah. I hope there's no unfortunate side effects of splicing elephant DNA with human DNA.
I mean,
so could just grow massive jumbo ears and get like an elephant trunk.
Yeah.
It is encouraging, and hopefully we'll be able to be applied to human beings. But yeah, pretty crazy. Yeah. Low cancer rates in elephants. So if you're a Buddhist and believe in reincarnation, come back as an elephant. Probably won't die of cancer.
Just poaching.
Just get killed by poaching, yeah.
Just poaching, yeah.
Beat me to it. My fact, actually, it's interesting. You made me think of another fact that I've forgotten I had learned this week, but I'm going to go with the one that I've chosen anyway.
You tease us.
I tease you. I like to tease you, Martin.
So do you want me to leave? Or
Yeah, get out, Alex. Get out.
This is a premium line, Alex. I don't know what you're doing on it.
So I learned this today, just before we started recording this podcast, because it just hit the news today. Italian police have found cocaine hidden inside coffee beans.
Inside coffee beans.
Which, I mean, it blew my mind, because I think they deserve points just for imaginative and, you know, skillful hiding of cocaine, you know, inside coffee beans.
Yeah, so it's just so frustrating. You do it with a bigger fruit, wouldn't you? Like,
you'd think. Avocado, orange, maybe. You know, that's fairly substantial. You know.
Yeah, I mean, that suggests that it's getting harder to smuggle this stuff. The law enforcement's probably doing quite a good job.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. So well done, Italian police, I suppose. But I thought, like, can you guess where the coffee beans came from?
Oh, Colombia.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Where else can you get cocaine and coffee? It's Colombia.
I mean, imagine if they forgot to take it out. That would be, you'd feel awake after that coffee, wouldn't you?
I know, right? Yeah, imagine grinding that in your Costa. Or Starbucks if you're anywhere else in the world.
My coffee's extra frothy.
I mean, yeah. But I mean, that would just kill you, wouldn't it? Straight up.
It probably would, yeah, actually.
I mean, how much cocaine do you reckon you can fit inside a coffee bean? Not much, really, can you?
No, I didn't check that. I think it's probably a gram at most, right? You think?
Yeah.
Yeah, if that's yeah.
But it'll still cost you what?
Well, I looked at sounds like I'm a cocaine addict, doesn't it? there was a Netflix show called The Drug Business, and I think they said that cocaine has remained. I don't quite remember what the name of the show is. I think it's called Drugs Business, and that it's remained remarkably stable over the past 40 or 50 years, both for farmers and for street value as well.
So if you're looking to invest.
I believe it was around $100 per gram.
Wow.
I think it was $100 per gram was the quoted amount. Wow. Which is, that's expensive, right?
Just before we move on, the icing on the cake of this story is that the package of coffee beans stuffed with cocaine was addressed to a pseudonym. It was addressed to a man called Santino D'Antonio, which is actually the name of the crime boss in John Wick Chapter 2.
Why would you do that? Why on earth would you have any link to anything to do with crime?
Well, you know, Michael Corleone wasn't working anymore, so they thought they'd go with John Wick instead.
We've heard about this story, so they got caught, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're idiots. Yeah. They're idiots.
In fairness, when you said that name, it didn't like spring to mind. But I was like, well, if you're going to call your kid that, of course they're going to grow up to be like a crime boss. So yeah, that makes sense.
Well, I'd love to know what you guys listening to us or watching us on YouTube at home think. So please get in touch either in the comments on YouTube or via our Twitter. My Twitter handle is @alltimerobin,
and my Twitter handle is @justalexing.
And mine is @martinteresting, like Martin Tresting.
Oh, that's clever. I like
that
one.
Makes any sense.
Or better still, you can post on our channel Twitter feed, which is @jinterestingyt.
Catchy.
Very catchy. Endlessly catchy. But speaking of what you guys at home think, let's have a look at our favourite comments of the past week. So I've got a comment from our last podcast episode, which was about solar cycles and the effects they have on human behavior, in particular, whether or not they trigger periods of mass protest and demonstrations like we've seen this year. But the comment has nothing to do with that. It's from Dennis Deacon, who said, "Don't worry, Alex. One day you'll find Dick Turpin, and then you'll have the last laugh.
I think I'm probably a bit late on finding Dick Turpin, to be honest. Yeah, maybe one day. He was never...
Maybe.
What happened to his remains after he was executed?
They're buried in York, I think.
Yeah.
He's got a gravestone, yeah.
I could literally go and find him, in fairness. And then I would have the last laugh.
You could. We'll go there at night and we'll dig him up, and then we'll be like, ha-ha.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be kind of ironic, wouldn't it? Robbing Dick Turpin.
Yeah, actually.
There's a video in that. There's definitely a video in that.
there's an arrest and jail time in that too.
Yeah,
I'll hire someone else. Someone else to do it for me.
So I have a comment from Jim M. It's actually more of a limerick. And he says, there once was a good man named Martin whose favourite hobby was farting. As bold as you'd please, he'd cut the cheese and waft it before quickly departing. That's quite astonishing. Very good, Jim.
Nice.
I replied saying that it was genuinely quite beautiful. And then he replied again saying, thank you, it genuinely came from the soul.
Wow.
That came from the soul.
The soul. Jim, very good, Jim.
Jim,
very
you
good.
Have a beautiful soul. Did you actually write that, Jim? That's amazing. That's incredible.
That was
great. I hope you did. Yeah. I hope you did.
Yeah. Well, he hasn't stolen it from somewhere, has he? It was custom made for Martin.
Well, yeah. Unless someone's made it before. But I think it's... Let's just quickly Google that.
Oh, no,
don't destroy the illusion. Oh, okay.
No, it's original. It's perfectly original. Well done, Jim.
Brilliant. Well done, Jim.
Sorry for ever doubting you. It's too good.
Well, the comment I wanted to read this week was from Sophie Shaw, who says, at this point, I think Robin is enjoying mentally torturing Alex with that buzzer. Yes, Sophie, I 100% agree. I think Robin is enjoying this greatly. Probably from all the laughter that accompanies the buzzer each week.
Oh yes,
it's so good. The thing is, Alex, it's the fact if you said it perfectly, it wouldn't be anywhere near as funny. It's the slight pauses. It's like show yourself. I love it,
Boudica.
I love it,
Boudica.
I've been.
It's amazing. Here that wants to
make contact. Oh come on, no. I thought this week I'd get at least 1 week's break from this. Did anyone dare here? Is Dick Turpin here? Stop it.
Is Dick Turpin in these woods? Show yourself.
That's the one. That's the one.
That's the bit. That's enough.
Oh, man.
Oh, it's too good.
Oh, so amazing.
It's too good.
The thing is, I've been scouring like some of the older videos, and I can't think of anything to get my revenge. But yeah. If anyone finds any great sound bites of Robin over any of our videos, please let me know. Because
if anyone wants to make contact with Alex, just just go to the woods and listen for his voice. He's there every night. Every night, he's shouting at the woods.
I hate you both. I'm quitting. I'm quitting this podcast. Oh,
if we ever get around to making some merchandise, that's definitely going on a t-shirt.
Oh, it totally is. Yes. Oh. Alex's face. Does anyone want to make contact? On the back, we'll have an alien.
That would be the saddest bit of merchandise.
Yeah, I mean, perfectly expecting no one to ever buy that. But it'd be good.
Nice. Oh, lovely. Shall we move on to our main topic?
Yeah, let's move on. Speaking of making contact, aliens.
Oh, that was a good segue, actually. Enjoyed that.
Thank you. Thank you. That was quite good. And we thought we'd just discuss, prompted by some of the comments we've seen, actually, discuss our favourite UFO sightings, because there's many documented UFO sightings. Some of them are more plausible than others, and we thought we'd just pick our favourite ones. So, Alex, what's yours?
Oh, picked on me first, eh? Okay, here we go.
I did.
So this one, I remember looking at this when we covered it before, and... I don't know, a lot of UFO sightings, I tend to be quite sceptical, and with a lot of them, there's always a catch, there's always a bit where you're like, oh, okay, there it is, that's why I don't believe this one. Whereas this one, I remember looking at and researching, and I just kept thinking, huh, okay, what? You know, you just struggle to, doesn't quite make sense. And that one for me was the Aerial School UFO sighting in Zimbabwe in 1994. Do you remember this one? Yeah. This was actually like a really compelling one. I'll go into the details. So on September 16th, 1994, at this school in rural Zimbabwe in a town called Rua, over 60 schoolchildren described seeing a disc-shaped craft land behind the school during morning break time. And the children reported seeing strange beings, and they received telepathic communication from them. And apparently the aliens told them that we as a species are causing great harm to the planet. And these are young, young children around like the age of 10 that had this telepathic communication with alien beings. Wow. And what I find really interesting about this is how the stories of these 60 school children were so consistent. They were all taken away and interviewed, and they all gave the exact same account of what they saw and the feelings that kind of were associated with that. And kind of what they experienced. Then they drew the craft, and each child's like drawing was incredibly similar. And then this actually made news headlines, global news headlines for a very short period of time in the 90s. But they sent a like really well-respected Harvard psychiatrist called Dr. John Mack. They sent him out to Zimbabwe to interview these children. And there's footage of this that you can watch on YouTube. And it's really, really interesting. And basically after investigating this, he came to the conclusion that they were telling the truth. And the school teachers at first kind of wrote off what these children were saying. But then over time, they were like, there's no way that the kids would remain this consistent in their story. Like at a certain point, some of the kids would tell something different or embellish a story in a certain way. Mm. But what was weird is how all of these children, these 60 children, just maintained their story and the feelings that they had when they saw this craft land behind the school and the drawings. And and then that has been maintained throughout their adult life as well. Now that they've grown up like 20 years later, all of these children are like maintain the story and maintain what they saw. And I just think that's incredible. Like something must have happened that freaked them out.
Exactly. Because you'd expect that with 60 children, as they got older, they could have quite easily made a pact back then that they would all keep consistent. But as they got older and you expect them to be maybe, you know, quote unquote, more rational, at least a few of them would be like, okay, we made a pact, or okay, this is probably what we actually saw. But yeah, as you say, remaining that consistent is quite remarkable for that many people.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool.
So something definitely happened. That's incredible.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some kind of interesting things. Nothing really debunks this one, but there's some interesting things that surround the case that could make you not believe it or make you believe it even more. So some of the details are, in this week that this happened on September 16th, 1994, Zimbabwe actually had another mass UFO sighting, I think just a few days earlier, on September 14th. And that was kind of like the first real UFO sighting that had become like really renowned for like in Zimbabwe. So there was like this mass UFO sighting nearby. So I don't know, maybe the kids saw that on the news and kind of internalized that. And maybe that's what prompted them to see something in the sky afterwards. Or you could look at it the other way and say that maybe there was actually some aliens visiting around this time. Yeah. And that's why there was a lot of alien activity on this particular week.
Because that's what's particularly interesting about this is that Zimbabwe doesn't really have a cultural history of UFO sightings at all.
That's it. That's what makes this interesting.
Yeah. Mm. And that's another thing that's interesting about it. And on top of that, you've got a lot of the people that were sent across, like some of the documentary crew that were sent across with Dr. John Mack.
Yeah.
They were also like completely convinced by these kids. And the questions that the psychiatrist was asking them and the answers that he got. If you watch it, it's chilling. Like, the answers that these kids give, they're not lying. You can kind of, you just know that they're not lying.
That's amazing.
They definitely saw something. However, what's interesting about this psychiatrist is he was actually investigated by Harvard. They questioned the authenticity of some of the research he was doing. Obviously, he had an interest in extraterrestrials. And there was basically an internal report filed by senior staff at Harvard Medical School. And he didn't lose his job, but they basically released this massively critical report of him, which is interesting because, I don't know, why was that seen as important? I don't know. And then he sadly died in the year 2000. He was hit by a drunk driver.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is really sad. The other point kind of against this is that there were 60 children who witnessed this, but also there was like 250 kids in the playground. But whether that makes it even more compelling that other people didn't join in with it, or less compelling because not all of them saw it, I don't know.
I mean, I think children are wonderful, but to be honest, I have so many doubts that 30 children would have the ability to collectively invent a story that they would consistently
lie
about. You know, it just, they're not capable of that. Children are messy, they're disorganized, and they're bad at keeping secrets. I just don't think they'd make that up so convincingly.
No. Yeah. They wouldn't. They wouldn't be able to. They wouldn't be able to keep that that common thread. Mm. Yeah.
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 It's definitely a really interesting case. I mean, there are some other interesting things about the school as well, because of its like geographic location. It's quite like, it was actually a really expensive school. I think it was like a private school. But apparently it was like, for the time as well, it was an incredibly diverse school. There were like children from all ages and all, not all ages, but like all ethnicities and backgrounds came to the school. I mean, I don't know why that's very important, but it just kind of gives an extra bit of color to the story that this, I don't know. It's like, if aliens were visiting a school, it's interesting to think that they would choose this one. One that's so diverse.
Yes. Yeah.
yes.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Makes a change from a dusty American, deserts and highways, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's also interesting the message that the aliens telepathically gave these kids, because obviously these kids wouldn't know much about like climate change or anything, but they said like they felt a level of dread and fear after this event, like seeing these aliens, and they just kind of felt really sad about the state of humanity and what we were doing to the planet. And it's like, a 10-year-old doesn't have those kind of feelings. Do you know what I mean?
Maybe not often. Yeah.
I think
nowadays, when there's more information about it and it's on the news, you are getting cases of quite young children being very, very anxious and worried about what's going on. 1994 in Zimbabwe. Yeah. I mean, maybe they've been learning about something similar to that at school, or have been suggested. I mean, where this really hits that roadblock about trying to disprove it is the consistency, isn't it? They're all kind of saying the same thing. And even, as Robin mentioned, although there was 240 kids who didn't witness this in the playground, to get that consistency between 60 of them, it would be almost impossible if they were completely making up.
Mm.
And they have maintained that, like, what they saw since they've become adults. And I feel like there is actually a new documentary out this year or about this incident that kind of takes some of their testimony. So maybe they earned some money from that, I don't know. But I mean, that would be a very long con, wouldn't it, if they were lying this whole time?
Yeah, they were thinking, back in 1994, they were thinking, one day Netflix will make a documentary and pay loads.
Maybe they're time travelers.
Maybe.
They knew it was going to happen.
Yeah. Mind blown! Yeah, the secret part of the telepathic message was, hold on, kids, there's this great thing called Netflix. You're gonna love it.
Yeah. But yeah,
oh, very good.
That was my story.
Very good. It's a good one. It's
That's a good one. That's a really good one, yeah.
Well, my one takes us back to 1967 and a little Canadian fishing village called Shag Harbour.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, not only one of the best UFO incidents, but also the best named UFO incident of all time.
they got Shag so, into the history books. It'll be forever documented. It's great.
Exactly, exactly. So Shag Harbour is in Canada, in the Nova Scotia region of the Atlantic coast. So in the east, southeast of Canada, kind of along the same kind of latitude to some of the northeastern states up there. So on the night of the 4th of October, 1967, a lot of the residents of Shag Harbour saw a low-flying, brightly lit object head towards Shag Harbour itself before it crashed into the sea and sank, leaving nothing except a yellowy-orange foam on top of the water. So witnesses, multiple witnesses, and that's one of the things that I think makes UFO sightings particularly believable, is if there's multiple witnesses who aren't necessarily able to corroborate with each other their stories before speaking to the police, but when they match up, as with the Zimbabwe one, when they match up, it's a lot more compelling. Mm. And so there were plenty of witnesses that saw these sequence of lights about, I think in total, it was about 60 feet in diameter, move at like a 45 degree angle really quickly towards the water surface. Yeah. And the witnesses said that these lights didn't seem to penetrate the water, but kind of floated on top of it a little way off the shore, mm-hmm. so about half a mile off the shore. Mm-hmm. And so immediately, as you would, you'd think it was an airplane crash. So a lot of these witnesses got in touch with the Coast Guard, who immediately went to investigate. But nothing was there. The lights were gone by the time they got there. And as I said, just this kind of orangey-yellow foam was left on the water itself. There were no details of any aircraft missing from air traffic control, and so it's a complete mystery as to what this was, but dozens of people saw this at the time. And like you say, Alex, a lot of these people, even as recently as this year, they have like an event every year where witnesses come and form a panel in Shag Harbour, and people go and listen to their testimony. And I think in 2019 there's still like 5-6 people who saw this at the time.
Wow.
And of course this happened in 1967.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you're talking 50 plus years on.
Wow.
People are still corroborating each other's story and are still saying it as they saw it. And you think after this amount of time, people wouldn't bother if this wasn't the case.
Yeah.
So they didn't manage to find anything. So I thought I'd go over some of the witnesses and give a little bit of background as to what people saw. And whether there are any possible explanations as to what this was. So one of the first people who witnessed these lights flash across the sky was a pilot and a co-pilot on an Air Canada flight, Flight 305. And Pierre Chabonneau and Bob Ralphington said they saw something out of the side of their aircraft, describing it as brilliantly lit, a rectangular object with a string of smaller lights trailing behind it. And there was another co-pilot in a different plane, a guy called Ralph Lowinger, who was flying from New York to London on a long-haul flight. He was on this panel, actually, and he said that he just happened to be looking out of the window and saw a formation of blue-white lights slanted from upper left to lower right. He said that it looked like a big airplane, like maybe a B-52 or a 707 with all of the lights on. And so he called up air traffic control, but they said that there was nothing on their radars. So he was convinced enough to call up air traffic control, and they were like, yeah, we hear what you're saying, but there's no evidence that this is in the sky, which is pretty crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So another witness at the time was a guy called Norman Smith. He was a teenager in Shag Harbour at the time. And he saw these lights in the sky and followed their direction until they crashed into the water. And his father and his uncle at the time were fishermen around the area. And so they jumped immediately into their fishing boat and headed for the water because they thought that, you know, it was most likely going to be a plane and that there was you know, going to be a rescue operation on. But they didn't see anything in the water at all. No material, just this yellowy orange foam in the water. And they said that it was about 4 to 6 inches thick above the water. And they searched all night, along with the Coast Guard, who later came, but they didn't see anything.
And they searched. Pretty mad. They searched all night as well. So they, yes, it's not like it was just a fleeting shot. You know, they spent all night sifting through this foam stuff.
Exactly, and found nothing. And this was along with the local Coast Guard and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police as well. So it's like a big operation going on here. And they found absolutely nothing except for this foam. So a lot of these witnesses heard similar things. They heard a sound like a bomb and a whoosh, and then a loud bang as the UFO kind of crashed into the water and caused this kind of floating light up on the top of it. So it was never officially identified. They couldn't find out exactly what it was. The Canadian military became involved, and a report was made by a local resident called Laurie Wickens, who was driving along with some of his friends on the Shag Harbour Highway 3. They spotted this aircraft heading towards the water. They said it was around 250 to 300 metres offshore. Got the Royal Canadian Mounted Police along, but yeah, nothing was ever found. So what is, I think what the thing that I like about this is, one, it's kind of, it's at a historical time where UFOs were popular, right? Yeah. You had Roswell 20 years earlier, so quite a long time earlier, but there's kind of this hype surrounding UFO incidents, but not so much in Canada. This is Canada's most famous UFO incident. I love the fact that it's not in a traditional UFO hotspot. It's in a tiny little fishing village. Mm-hmm. And I really like the fact that it's corroborated by quite a few different types of people. And so these townspeople are still trying to come to terms with what happened 50 plus years ago today.
Yeah. That's the thing. Like, so many different witnesses, like pilots and townspeople, and the fact that, like, you know, the Canadian military got involved. There's something happened. There's no doubt that something happened.
But I think one of the bits that really makes this interesting to me is the testimony of a guy called Bill Bordereau, who worked at a secret US military base where they were monitoring subterranean underwater frequencies from Russian submarine activity. And this base was just 30 minutes from the crash site itself. And so he said on this panel last year, he said, it's no wonder conspiracy theorists like to have a heyday with this particular UFO event, because quite frankly, there does seem to be a lot of ammo. Perhaps the US military knew something that these people didn't, right? Everyone who saw this didn't. Could it have been a UFO that they then covered up and swept away the debris before anyone got there? Or could it have been some kind of test, maybe a military test, that that all these people saw? So it was a UFO, but it wasn't of alien origin.
Yeah, it comes back to the original definition of UFO as an unidentified flying object, and in the early days how governments were concerned during the early years of the Cold War that a UFO was a piece of foreign tech as opposed to necessarily aliens. That's interesting. Like Alex said, like, I'm 100% on board with the idea something happened.
Oh, most definitely.
They saw something real. Yeah.
Yeah.
But also I felt like, at the kind of like the most believable, or like the at the bare minimum, it would be like a military cover up of some military tech failure, of some secret equipment that they didn't want the public to know about. That's at the bare minimum of what this could have been. It's such an interesting story.
It also makes the recounted tales of this orange foam quite strange, though, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it could just be sea foam, couldn't it? And maybe people that thought they saw this aircraft crash into the water, what they're actually seeing was just a buildup of sea. I don't know. Like, hearing bangs and stuff, I'm not sure. I mean, in terms of physical evidence, no wreckage was found, only this foam. But a diver called David Savette, he's a guy who's been surveying the ocean floor of the harbour for years and years and years, has claimed to have actually discovered anomalies in the area where this UFO supposedly crashed.
Oh, yeah.
So what he's found is like depressions on the ocean floor, which don't match up with the rest of the area. And one thing about them is that they're perfectly circular, which suggests in the traditional sense that it could have been some kind of UFO crash landing, right? Perfect circle. But then again, a lot of the reports suggest that this particular UFO was like a series of lights as opposed to like a traditional flying saucer. So an interesting one. It might not mean anything, but it is interesting that someone who is a diver and has been studying the area says there are anomalies with the findings on the ocean floor, like something has crash landed into the ocean floor.
Definitely,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so there's so many moving parts to this.
Oh, it's a legendary case, isn't it?
It's a good one. Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And I don't think we're ever going to get a definitive answer. But I do feel like something definitely happened there. And I love the idea of this kind of probably slightly decaying Atlantic town, you know, sea-swept Atlantic town.
Mm.
Has a whole load of people there still after all this time who are just wondering what the hell went on back then.
Mm.
They know what they know what they saw, but they don't know what they saw, right?
Yeah. I think the Shag Harbour incident, like, I'm going to put my neck on the line and say, hands down, the most plausible UFO sighting.
It's right up there.
It's definitely up there. Yeah, good choice.
Thank you.
Well, good luck. Good luck following that, Robin.
Yeah, I feel but a bit of a come down. Although interestingly, we've kind of gone backwards in time. So Alex was 1994, Martin's gone to 1967, and mine goes all the way back to 1945.
Ooh, before Roswell.
Yeah, before Roswell. So you may have heard the term Foo Fighters. You're familiar with this phenomenon that arose in the latter part of the Second World War when pilots for the Allies would encounter UFOs. The first UFOs, and they'd call them Foo Fighters. Or at least the US airmen would call them Foo Fighters. But this one's about RAF, British pilots, and sorry, air crew, who encountered the UFO. And so at the end of World War II, an RAF reconnaissance plane was returning from a mission over occupied Europe when it was shadowed by a metallic UFO off the coast of Cumbria in northern England. And the object hovered noiselessly by the plane, and the crew, because it was a reconnaissance plane and they had photographic equipment on board, purportedly took pictures of it.
Ooh,
I don't think I've seen that.
Yeah, we mentioned this on the channel that shall not be named. But not much is known beyond this point because, and this is known for sure, our Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, personally ordered that this incident be classified, and he specified for at least 50 years, and even after that point, details could only be released with the approval of a Prime Minister.
Okay.
And apparently, Churchill said, this should be immediately classified, since it would create mass panic among the general population and destroy one's belief in the church.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Now, we only know about this because supposedly Churchill's personal bodyguard, who was also an RAF officer, gave a deathbed confession. And in 1999, his grandson wrote to the Ministry of Defence inquiring about the incident because throughout the 1990s, the Ministry of Defence had been declassifying the files from the official military UFO investigations which had been carried out in response to Churchill's orders for several decades and were being wound down and brought to a close in the 1990s. And as they closed the files, they released them to the public. But there is no record of this particular UFO sighting or Churchill's orders regarding it because the Ministry of Defence says that all UFO files from before 1967, coincidence, have been destroyed.
Wow.
You've got to ask yourself why.
Yeah. Apparently, I'm sure if you asked, they would say an administrative error.
Your warehouse burned down.
But my immediate suspicion, it's hard not to think, oh, they've kept keeping those pre-1967 ones top secret. But there is a little bit more to this one, because there are no original files available to the public, at the very least, and according to the Ministry of Defence, they have been destroyed. What versions of the story we've got do have discrepancies. So, for instance, often it's said that the incident took place off the east coast of northern England, which makes sense because they're returning from Europe, which is to the east of the UK. So the plane is coming in from Europe to the east coast, except Cumbria is on the west coast of England.
It is.
So
it is.
There's different versions, one that says it's on the west coast and one that says it's on the east coast. Mm. That's a bit weird. There's also versions of the story that say it was a bomber plane. It wasn't a reconnaissance plane.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's slight differences here.
Yeah, and then there's this whole vagaries of the deathbed confession by the grandfather of the guy who made the inquiry. So I'm one of those people who's always a bit suspicious when a deathbed confession is involved. You know, how much should we give credit to those kind of things? But I find this fascinating because it's one of the few cases where someone as prominent as Winston Churchill is involved saying UFOs, and we know he did say this, UFOs are a threat to people's belief in the church. You know, and we know that in 1952, he ordered an official UFO investigation, which didn't end until the 1990s.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah, that is insane. Just for that fact alone.
Yeah.
It is remarkable.
Yeah.
What did he know when he said that quote?
This, makes you wonder.
They have the risk to diminish people's faith in the church. Yeah. He's seen some aliens. Winston Churchill has seen aliens.
He's seen some.
He's either seen aliens or he's seen something that resembles aliens so well that he thinks people will believe it and that it will then cause issues with faith.
Yeah. So yeah, that was my UFO story. I don't think it's as compelling as Shag Harbour or the Zimbabwe incident. I think that both of those are really compelling. But
I think maybe it's one that people know less about, though.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I hadn't heard some of those things before, and it's always interesting to learn something new. And it's been really nice, actually, just talking about UFO stories. It's been, you know,
a nice break.
With everything depressing going on, it's nice getting a bit of mystery. I'd be interested to know, though, what you guys think. Firstly, which story is the most compelling out of our ones, and if there's any other UFO stories that you know that you think is the most compelling UFO story, let us know.
Or what's your favourite? It could be crazy.
You
know that it's not necessarily true, but you just love it.
Yeah.
Let us know.
Tell us here, what is your favourite UFO story or alien story? And vote for your favourite story that we talked about in this podcast. And the winner will get chocolate.
Yeah.
You're promising them chocolate. You're going to send some chocolate out. You heard it here first.
I'm rigging the vote.
We're setting up dozens of YouTube accounts.
Yeah.
Just about.
And speaking of winning, shall we do a quiz?
Yes, I'd love to.
Yeah. Welcome to the quiz. As always, there'll be 10 questions plus a bonus question for any tie-breaking, and probably just for fun anyway, because we always do it. And this week it's Alex versus Martin. Martin is top of the league tables.
One from one.
Yeah, just with one.
Yeah.
Just one.
100% victory one. Rate.
That sounds better than it is, but thank you.
Yeah. So, Alex, all you have to do is win this, and everybody's level pegging in the league.
Everyone will be equal. Yeah. Yeah. I need this. I need to win this. I can't stay at the bottom for the second season running.
For kind of symmetry's sake, if nothing else.
Yeah. Exactly. There's a lot riding.
Nice to see us all.
Symmetry is riding on this.
All right then. So let's hear your buzzers, Alex.
I've gone for the tried and tested method for this week.
French champagne has always been celebrated for its excellence. There's a California champagne.
Probably put that on for slightly too long then. I just can't get enough.
It's just can't.
You've got to show the whole thing, haven't you? You know, at least at the beginning.
Yeah, just too good. Anyone who hasn't seen that video, go on YouTube and watch it. It's fantastic. Martin, what have you got?
Oh, it's the same as last week. It was a winning formula last time, so Delia's done me proud. Delia Smith, everyone's favourite East Anglian TV chef. Come on. Yeah.
I love this. We've got two drunk celebrities.
Yeah.
True.
As our buzzers.
Match made in heaven.
All right, then, on to question one. Fingers, okay. Buzzers at the ready. This is just general knowledge, and I wrote this myself, and I think I've got all the answers correct. So
that's the bare minimum with a quiz, Robert.
As I said, I just kind of based this on my own general knowledge, so we'll find out.
I thought you were going to bring out a guitar then, Robin. I wrote this one myself.
Here's one. No, not like that. So hopefully this is all fine.
Okay.
We'll find out. Point is, you'll be wrong or right based on what I think is true, and that's the important
thing. That's what matters. Yeah, that's the universal truth.
Okay. Question number one. In Britain, what does BBC stand for?
California Shop.
I heard Orson first.
British Broadcasting Corporation.
Ooh, well done.
Oh, I was worried then for a
1-0
second.
1-0 to
Alex. Very good.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Question number two. Where would you find the Sea of Tranquility?
His Excellence. There is a California.
Oh, that was close, but I think it was Orson again.
Sorry, Martin. On the moon?
Yes, it's on the moon. Well done.
Okay. Yeah. Early lead. Plenty of time for Martin to come back. 2-0. Not counting.
Okay. Mm-hmm. No, this is a tough one. Question number three.
Okay.
True or false? Sharks have no bones in their bodies.
For its excellence. It's buzzing in. California.
He's just straight in there, isn't he?
Just
yeah.
Just buzzing in.
Alex?
False.
Eric.
Okay. Martin? What's your guess?
Well, I guess I've got to go for true then, haven't I? Yeah, true.
Martin, you would be correct.
They have no bones in their body.
Sharks have no bones, just cartilage.
What the hell?
What? I know.
What?
No. Don't like that. Don't like that at all. What about their teeth?
Well,
do they count?
They're bony bones, are they? Calcium.
Now you're making me doubt myself.
I need to look this up.
Don't look it up.
Don't look it up now. Don't look it up now.
Okay.
Martin has a point. 2-1 to Martin.
it was true. Okay.
According to Robin.
According to Robin's memory
of the world.
According to Robin's shaky memory, it's true.
Fact checkers unite, and tell us in the comments on YouTube below whether or not that's true.
It's like Alan Partridge phoning. Injecting yourself with Ribena cures diabetes.
Oh,
it
so
doesn't.
2-1 to Alex, going on to question four. What was the first sports movie to win the Best Picture Oscar?
Ooh.
First sports movie.
Oh. Martin, yeah.
I'm going to go for Chariots of Fire.
That did win Best Picture Oscar, and it is a sports movie, but it's not the first.
Not the first, okay.
Wow. Oh, okay. Mm.
But we're looking early here, aren't we? Wow.
I don't know when that film came out. So.
Goodness.
What's it called? I've got one that I'm thinking of. Can I describe the film, or do I have to say
you can? But then I might get it.
Oh, okay. I can't describe it as my answer.
Well, it's up to you, Robin, but I don't think that. It doesn't sound legit.
Doesn't sound legit at all, does it? I'm reaching. I'll be honest, mate, I'm reaching.
Okay. Okay, I'll give you a clue before you both buzz in with your next question.
Okay.
How's that?
Okay.
Sounds good.
It's a famous movie you'll both have heard of.
Okay.
Sports film.
Excellence.
Yeah.
There's a California champagne.
California champagne. Yes, Alex.
I don't know if this counts as sports, but Ben-Hur.
I mean, I did win Best Picture, but apart from the chariot race, which is one sequence in a four-hour movie, that's not a sports movie.
You could count it as a sports film, surely.
Slavery, the latest sport. No, that's not. That's
okay,
not.
Fair enough.
I'm trying to think of early sports movies. I'm just trying to think now. Mm. Oh, what sports they could include, right? That's why not, just say anyway. I was going to say Raging Bull. That's later.
Oh, actually, that was 1980. That was before Chariots of Fire. But it did not win Best Picture. Won Best Actor and was nominated for Best Picture, but did not win. However...
Oh, what about?
Oh.
Sorry, yeah, I've got another thought, but Alex, you have another one.
I don't know.
Go for it, Martin.
Million Dollar Baby?
No, that wasn't the first sports movie to win the Best Picture Oscar. That was 2000, early 2000.
Is it later?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was.
I thought it might be an early version.
So, but I mean, I'll give you a big clue, so fingers on buzzers.
Okay.
Martin's last two guesses have been the right.
I know it's the right. Oh. Yeah. No, I kind of won it. I was going to go for Rocky. Okay.
It is Rocky.
Oh my God. Really? So
yeah,
stupid.
Rocky won. Yeah, back in 1976.
So I didn't know I won it. Okay.
Yeah, and it won Best Original Screenplay, and Sylvester Stallone was nominated for Best Actor.
Blimey.
Yeah.
It's quite easy back then, isn't it?
Ooh, cruel. Scathing. But he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Creed as Rocky Balboa. So he's one of the few times, I think possibly the only time, an actor has been nominated more than once for playing the same character.
I feel like we probably should have given up with that question before we got there, in fairness.
And,
we had quite a few guesses.
And that's interesting because it's for the main role and supporting. Yeah. That's the same character. Yeah.
Yeah. How times change. The typical trajectory of a Hollywood career.
Yeah.
Okay, so two all. Going into question five, and this is the closest wins.
Okay.
So, in what year was the first Nobel Prize ceremony held?
Ooh.
First Nobel Prize ceremony.
Oh, God. Mm. Ceremony. Not just given up, the ceremony.
I think they did coincide. I think it might be the first Nobel Prize as well.
Oh.
No,
do
you
want to have a go? Yeah, I want to have a go.
Nobel Prize. First Nobel Prize. Okay, yeah, we have a go. Why not?
Okay, Martin.
18. Why not?
Okay, Alex, you got a
closer. That is very close to when I was actually guessing.
Okay,
I'm going to guess.
There's a California.
Not to be a total dick. 1905.
Oh. Alex, I think you've actually earned this one because it's 1901.
Oh, well done.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very good.
Not just the classic, I'm going to go a year either side of the previous guest. No, that was great. 1901, the first Nobel Prize ceremony. So, 3-1 to Alex going into question
3-2, but yeah.
Sorry, 3-2. Completely right. Don't know where that came from. 3-2 to Alex going into question 6. What is the national animal of Scotland?
There's a California. Oops,
straight in there. That was Alex, I think.
Is my guess?
Yeah, your guess.
Is it the unicorn?
Yes.
Bloody hell, it is.
I remember this. I remember this.
Yeah,
factors.
I remember this, yeah.
Yeah.
Well done. I thought that's a worthwhile question since we're all going to move to Scotland. We'd better start practicing our citizenship test knowledge.
I'd ace it already.
Fowl's the thistle, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, you don't get a point for that.
That's not a question.
No, just bonus knowledge.
No bonus point. So 4-2, I'm afraid.
4-2, man, I need to get my buzzer skills.
Question 7. So, how many American states begin with the letter E?
There's a California champagne by Palmer.
That's Alex, yep.
Is it my guess?
Yeah, it's your guess.
0.
That is correct.
Yes!
Knowledge base there.
It didn't sound. I thought it
doesn't. Yeah,
I just had a feeling that would be.
I tried to word it in a cleverer way, but then it just got too complicated to try to phrase it any differently. So on to question 8, and it's currently 5-2. So I think Martin, you can bring this back. Yeah.
I can.
Yeah, you can.
Okay,
and you will, and I will storm out of the podcast as when that always seems to happen.
Diva, going on. Switching your geometry brains on, how many edges does a cube have?
Buzzes first, thinks later.
So fast, isn't it?
Ridiculous.
So fast. Okay.
We should write these down from now on. It's just becoming a buzzer test.
I guess 12.
Oh, you guess, do you? You guess. Martin, do you have a guess?
Well, I can take my time now, can't I?
I mean, you can.
Well, just
it's the
yes
same. It's 12. Yeah,
it's a yes 12, or no. So,
well, you're both correct, so you both get a point.
What the hell? It's not how this works.
That's how it works, isn't it?
So I mean, actually, it's fine. You can do that.
I mean, it's still Alex fine. Still wins that way. Yeah. So 6-2 to Alex going into
6-3. Yeah, it's okay.
6-3. Yeah, 6-3 going into question 9.
Okay.
We're all fans of drink. We've established that quite firmly. We like beer. We like whiskey.
I like beer.
In what country is gin believed to have been invented? Now that was
a question. That was a question I buzzed.
That was Martin.
I buzzed in very quickly, but indeed. I don't know the answer.
Oh.
Which is kind of that's kind of the tactic, though, right?
That is
tactic I usually opt for. Yeah.
Invented.
Yeah. In
invented.
Which country is gin believed to have been invented? Yeah. Where does gin
invented?
From? Yeah.
Well, in London it's very popular in London, but I don't think that's probably not where it's invented.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to go for India.
That is incorrect.
Okay.
Alex, do you have a guess?
I'll do
the QI buzzer answer and say, is it the UK?
No, it is not the UK. As Martin said, it's very infamously popular in London and still is in the UK. But it's not either of those. I'll give you a clue.
Okay.
This country is also famous for its beer.
Oh.
Okay.
That was Martin. That was Julia.
Is it going to be Belgium?
It is Belgium. Well done. So the earliest known reference to gin is from Bruges in like the 1300s, I think.
Hmm.
And after that, it's Antwerp in the 15 or 1600s, quite some time later.
So it is Belgium, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think gin comes from the Dutch word for the juniper berry or something, I think.
Cool.
Of course, they speak Dutch in Flemish and other things in Belgium. That sounds a bit dismissive, doesn't it? They speak other things over there.
They speak a few languages, don't they?
Those foreigners don't speak English, so it doesn't matter. Okay, that's 6-4 going into question 10.
Mm-hmm.
Who wrote the novel Jurassic Park?
Jurassic Park.
Who is it? I recognise the name. I can't.
I'm embarrassed. I don't know the spot.
If it was multiple choice, I think I'd know which one it was.
Can you make it multiple choice?
I'll make it multiple choice. Okay. Is it A, Arthur C. Clarke? B, Michael Crichton?
Mm-hmm.
Or C? Is it A or B?
You know what? That didn't really help.
Can I have a guess?
Alex is buzzed.
Go for it.
Is it B, Michael Crichton?
It is Michael Crichton. Well done.
I should have thought harder of another author.
So well done, Alex. That's a pretty decisive victory, isn't it? 7-4.
Very good.
Four.
Very good.
Thank you. I'm just relieved more than anything. Relieved that we're all level pegging. Just for the symmetry. I didn't even care about winning. You know, it was just
yeah,
it was
we've
just
all
the
got
symmetry.
It, 50% thing. Yeah. This is great. This is good.
Yeah.
Very good.
This makes the league table important. Do you want the bonus question?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah. Okay. Now this might be a tricky one, but we'll go for it. So bonus question. On the Fujita, or F scale, what number...
Fujita is a Mexican food dish, right?
That's racist. What number...
Fujita.
Chicken
Fujita. On the... How spicy is this Fujita? No,
a character from Dragon Ball Z, but no, that's fine.
Well, that's closer. This is a Japanese scientist, all right? So on the Fujita scale, or F scale, what number represents the strongest kind of tornado?
What number?
Good question. Okay, why not? Let's go for 8.
Okay.
There's a California.
Yeah, champagne.
I'm going to go the other way and say this is like DEFCON 1. Be 1. Ooh, say 1.
Interesting.
Oh, sorry. No, go on. So tell Martin he's
just,
right.
He's just closer. He's just closer. It's
five.
F5. It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. Anyone who loves the film Twister, which was written by Michael Crichton and his wife, will get that answer. Yeah. So, well done. That was Well played, sirs.
Good
well
quiz. Done, Alex. Good quiz,
thank
Robin.
You for the quiz, Robin.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well done, Alex.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Please let us know your scores at home if you've been playing along. And also, please let us know if sharks have bones or not.
Because... I mean, there is an issue with people playing along at home, which is they should only be able to get a point if they've buzzed in quicker than us, right?
That's true. Yeah, that's what, I can never hear their buzzers. They're just so slow.
Exactly.
So slow.
It's true. Everyone has got zero so far. So.
But if you enjoyed this, then please head on over to our Patreon, where for just $1 a month, you can get an extra, little bit more interesting podcast. And thank you again for listening. Thank you again for supporting us. And we'll see you next time.
Yes.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Hey, guys. Have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country. Anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.